accession number 30277, reel 6.
Most of it was requests for stores, ammunition, rifles, food, of course, medical supplies, and whatever had been gleaned from the different operatives. They were all working on their own, just single men with their little party of local Ebans, Muruts, Kalabits, whatever they chose. Each one was working individually and sending back information. Anything that was worthwhile sending back, Tom Harrison would write it up and send it to me. I would encode it and send it back. And most of the incoming was regarding stores that they were packing and preparing to watch out for drops. But another thing that confused the whole issue at this stage of the game and delayed things considerably, and I never found this out until long, long years later, was that when I took over as the operator, my hand was totally different to the previous operator, totally different, and they were immediately suspicious that it was Japanese sending. And this, of course, delayed things. Well, probably for a number of weeks, they were unsure about this operator that was sending these messages through. And the first reinforcements that were sent in, which would have been quite a few weeks later, they were told that when they saw the red signs, the red or white signs on the ground, because Harrison had some big lumps of calico and he put H, a big H on the ground, and that was for them to drop. And they were told by Brigadier Wills not to drop out there, to go a couple of miles further on and go out and then take up a defensive position ready to fight. But of course it wasn't necessary.
Yeah. What were you gleaning from the Japanese presence here at this time?
Not very much, because our fellows hadn't made any contact with the coast at that stage. They were being very cautious because they didn't know who was going to give them away if they got too familiar with some of the locals in Lawas or Sipitang or any of those sort of coastal and semi-coastal kampongs or townships. So there wasn't a lot that we were putting through at that stage. We did report 5 Japanese seaplanes on one of the rivers, and I understand that the Air Force came in and dealt with them. Memory, that's my trouble. thinking about there was a lot of discussion about the sawmill that was in British North Borneo, and that was operating by Japanese. Reports were coming in from down the Rejang from Fred Sanderson. he was finding a few odd Japanese around the place, mainly the farming types and those coming up the river to look for vegetables and rice and things like that. But not a lot of stuff that I could see of great importance or value at that stage.
Bring you in anyway. I understand at one point you would be supplied with locals as assistants or
oh yes
guards in a way.
Yes, well I had to have somebody to wind the generator while I keyed the traffic out and of course received. So at Barrio, they supplied me with these two young fellas who were armed with their parings and blowpipes and poison darts. And they were good workers, and we got rid of it all. And one time I was talking to them, and they said, one of them said to me, if you got a rifle, you got an American carbine, he said, it good snapping is gun, good. This was all in Malay, of course, because they couldn't speak a word of English, and I was not that good at Malay, so I had to sort it out as they spoke. But his theme was that if you get hit with one of my bullets, it might go into your arm or your leg, and you don't die. But he said, with my sumpitan, my blowpipe, the poison dart, hit your little finger, you're dead. And I got the message. Yes, that was the first two. And then later, of course, when we got to Parmain, we were up this big hill. We only went on the air after dark. And these two warriors would come up the big stairway with their damar torches, their flaming torches, to light the way. And once they were up there, they would extinguish them. And one would wind the generator, and I would key the traffic out to Darwin and then receive. And the other one would be rolling cigars on his thigh, perspiration and all, big grey-green leaf tobacco in big cigars, one for him, his mate, one for himself and one for me. Yes, it was interesting the time we were there. These fellas couldn't speak a word of Malay, these blokes, so there was absolutely no way of conversing with them whatsoever. Anything you did was sign language. One thing that fascinated me was how they lit their cigars or lit a fire. In their left hand they would put this little bit of, looked like kapok. It was actually bark from trees that had been buried and then dug up and dried out. It was like a fluffy little bit of stuff. Between their fingers they'd have a piece of metal or the flint might be there, the stone might be there, and the metal might be in their right hand. They'd strike it like that and a spark would hit this thing. They'd blow it and the next thing it would be a light and they'd light their cigarette. Their cigar. They had nice hard hands. Yeah, fascinating, you know, when we think of making a fire and with the old sticks or anything like that, you know, it's always been impossible for me. A bit later on, one of the locals found one of our torpedoes. And this fellow arrived with a trade blanket and 100 boxes of wax matches. in it. I gave him 50 Malay cents for it, and off he went. And I got a tin of them out and struck one, and it was no good. And the whole lot were the moisture, the humidity had just ruined the whole lot of them. So I left the whole lot there when I pulled out. I guess the locals thought the tins were marvellous. I don't know whether they what they did with the match part of it, but yes, bit of interesting.
Well, you mentioned in your book the sort of pattern of life in the jungle.
Yes. Well, it was sort of not really jungle up there. It was a beautiful clearing, and we had wonderful weather during that time. But go 50 yards over the cliff edge and down, and you're in deep jungle. And of course, the story there was, if you get off the track for more than a few minutes, you're lost, and the chances of being found again are very remote. And one morning we had a troop of monkeys came through over the trees, and there must have been 500 of them, I reckon, chattering away and swinging through the trees. Yeah, marvellous sight. Pity we didn't have video cameras. Yes. The later, well, we Dan Illerick arrived there. He was the wireless air gunner from the Army Air Force Liberator that had been shot down. And he was the fittest one, and he was able to do more slowly, but at least he was able to do it. And also he was fairly good at the code. When we shifted from there, we had to go over the 7,000 foot mountain, and that was intriguing too. And I think in my book I called it the birthplace of rivers, because it was tiny little rivulets of beautiful clear water up there. And right on the top we were in permanent cloud, and the trees grew in strange shapes, and everything dripped, just everything. It was marvellous.
Presumably a difficult place to get things like radios to work.
Oh, it would have been impossible up there. It would have got into the works in a matter of a few hours, I should imagine, and stopped it working, yes. Yes, fortunately, the worst place we ever had was that first place. That was really damp and not a good place for anything like radio equipment. But,
you're in touch, I understand, with some Americans here as well.
Yes.
Liberator Air Force.
The Dan Illerick's crew.
This was at Barrio.
They weren't at Barrio. They were at a place called Palamatut, which I look for on the map many, many times because they say it so quickly. Palamatut. And when I actually did eventually find it, it was Poedoetoe, etc., in the Dutch spelling. But it was no doubt there. It was a couple of days travel from where I was at the time. Dan joined me at Parmain, and he stayed with me all the time I was there, Parkaback, Limbadut, and for quite a few weeks at Balawit when the bamboo strip was being constructed. And of course, eventually, the Americans, some were in a bit pretty bad way. The first one that was flown out, I understand he was... He passed away only a few years ago. Dan fills me in on this type of thing. And he was one of the Navy plane. The Navy one As you know, they brought the aircraft down into the paddy field with the wheels up landing, and most of them got out okay. They couldn't agree on whether to go to the coast and give themselves up or go inland, and that's where they parted. Some went to the coast and were never seen or heard of again, and the others went inland and they were looked after and all flown out eventually with the Austers. Dan's aeroplane was Army Air Force, and they weren't quite so lucky, in as much as I think their pilot and co-pilot and engineer might have been others was killed in the anti-aircraft fire, and the plane was still flying, but I think it was flying in circles, so they decided to parachute out, and Dan was one of the survivors. Can't remember the numbers now, but it's probably somewhere in the stats of the book or something like that.
Hi.
Hi.
I'll point to you and you can continue.
Yes.
What sort of interaction did you have with the native population, the indigenous people there?
Oh, we had early on, we had a very, very friendly and a wonderful interaction. Mind you, we were dependent on them. We were dependent on them for food. Most of our food was lost, and we grew accustomed to having rice three times a day, boiled rice. And at Parmain, my second wireless station, I had a smoky little fire out the front of the Sulap, which had a row of sticks, and then a row of meat, and a row of sticks, and a row of meat. And the smoke from that preserved it. It was pretty tough going, mind you, but at least it was sustenance. And that, together with the boiled rice, kept us going, not for weeks, but for months. Lost a bit of weight.
Where were you when you heard that VE Day had taken place? Do you remember?
Yes, I was at Balawit. I can't remember what month that would have been.
It was May.
May. No, I wasn't at Balawit, I was still at Parmain. But by the time I got to Balawit, I found out there, which would have been early June, we had a fellow come in, his name was Smith, and I don't know much else about him. But he told me that it was all over in that area. Yes, Europe. European war was over.
How did that make you feel, and the rest of the troop?
It didn't influence us a great deal. We were sort of thinking along the lines of the long haul, I suppose. And Harrison, our boss, he was... he told us he was planning to take us into China next. He was thinking ahead. Egotistical man, but thinking ahead, yes, he pretty brilliant in his way. Not very popular, mind you, as the book would tell you.
Why not?
He had the policy that he could live on boiled rice and go barefoot, and everybody else should do the same.